This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sian Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
Hi, welcome to the Legarten Institute. Today we have a very special guest, Sergei Popovich, who was the leader of the revolutionary movement Otpor in Serbia that overthrew Milosevic, and since then has become a sort of... actually, Sergei, why don't you explain it to me yourself? What exactly do you do now since leading this very famous revolution?
Well, I'm running a small NGO called Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies, which is a kind of the hub where people who start social movements around the world come to learn how to build their movements more effectively. And we have worked with a group from maybe 46 different countries, from Asia to North America, from the groups dealing with the fighting for democracy and human rights to the anti-corruption and environmental groups.
So you're sort of like an NGO that consults civic groups how to create a non-violent revolution.
We developed a curriculum to help people build a movement if the movement is revolutionary in terms of democracy. In some cases, we worked with people from Maldives, Georgia, Ukraine, who were involved in nonviolent revolutions. In some cases, we work with smaller movements dealing with a more community organizing. But the technology and know-how on how to effectively mobilize nonviolent movement, it's something we are particularly passionate about. And last few years, we expanded it into university curriculum. We will be teaching it in University of Essex here in UK next year. We're having it at NYU and Harvard. So there is a growing interest in, you know, how these movements operate, why they succeed, why they fail, things like that.
So tell me, you've just written a new book. That's why you're in London at the moment. Tell me about the book.
The Blueprint for Revolution is a book of the common people who are changing the world and how the political nobodies can actually have shaken the world in terms of Lech Walesa and Martin Luther King and Harvey Milk and also the people from Otpor. But also it tells a very compelling stories about the creativity, use of humor and nonviolent tactics, which were, you know, David against Goliath type struggles. It also touches a little bit of the how-to in terms of understanding the principles of successful nonviolent struggle, things like unity, planning, nonviolent discipline, playing with the oppression, using of the creativity and humor against the oppression and how this thing backfired, but also the importance of background strategy and clear vision if you want to build the different society. It's a very easy read and it's not made for people like you and me, people who are kind of interested in the subject. Is basically on a college student level, and people who really want to be revolutionaries in their own environment should read it.
No, I actually recommend it to anyone because as you say, it's a blueprint that could be used to create a revolution, to change something in your community, or in, you know, your personal relationships. It's a way to get a girl as well. It's actually a strategy for, you know, how to influence sort of social groups and other people. No, it's a fantastic read. It's a fantastic book. You have a lot of examples in your book. You talk about sort of attempts at revolutions or social movements in Ukraine, Russia, Syria, Egypt. Basically, everything we've seen on television, where there's been, you know, very intense social change, Otpor and Canvas, your NGO, seem to have been at the heart of it. Not all of those were successful. Why are some successful and why do others fail?
Well, I mean, it's like if you look at the statistics, and there is a great book by Erika Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, you will understand that 52% of nonviolent revolutions succeed in terms 52% of nonviolent campaign, as opposed to the, of course, 26% of the violent campaign. So that's encouraging. You can also see the percent of the nonviolent revolution ending up in democracies is like, you know, 42%, as opposed to the violent solution, which is 4%. So, you know, it's like, this is also encouraging. Well, the question is, what is behind the successful movements? And because the context differs, but you know, it's like even however struggles are different, for example, in Maldives and Ukraine because of the social context, religious context, geography context, but there are principles that successful movements use. They all have the clear vision of tomorrow. They're all capable to build up strategy plan. They're all capable to build and maintain the unity or variety of the social players. And of course, they were able to play on the card of a nonviolent discipline rather than, you know, slipping into violence. On another hand, the big question, which book doesn't answer to, but it touches it a little bit, is why the movements failed and why we were witnessing such a tremendous things like, you know, events in Egypt, for example. And you've seen young people catching completely military and Mubarak and even the international community completely off guard. You know, they didn't expect this to happen. And then after this marvelous party when Mubarak steps down, we are slipping back and back and back. And, you know, it looks at the reasons why some of these revolutions fails. And it tells a story about, you know, proclaiming a game over too early in the process. Looking at the personalities rather than the values, because one of the reasons, for example, why Serbian revolution and transition was reasonably successful, that in the center of it was not Milosevic. It was kind of the values, like things like democracy, European Union, peace with neighbors. So once you build around these values, it is very likely that the values will prevail. So now we are having a government which is completely different political orientation than the one we had after the revolution. Still, this government is pushing country into European Union because it became a kind of the Serbian political mainstream. Whether if you were building around Mubarak, Mubarak steps down, you make a party, and then of course the government is there for somebody to take it over. Obviously in Egypt, the two most organized groups are struggling for power ever since. Muslim Brotherhood, which was in the offense first, and now we have a military who has been taking it over. So there are several reasons why this movement fails, but I think it's a very, very big challenge for us to try to find an answer to the question how to follow up the successful revolution with a successful transition to democracy.
Yeah, no, that's clearly a very big challenge. And here at Legarton, we did a few case studies about Georgia, which was one of the greatest examples of a very successful revolution, but also a very interesting transition period afterwards, which was largely positive, but with mixed results. I mean, it's very interesting reading your book because you know there was a swell of these non-violent movements in Georgia, after your one in Serbia, Georgia, and then leading all the way up to Egypt, and Ukraine as well. But Maidan, the recent Ukraine revolution, at the end of the day, it may have started as a non-violent, but it became violent. And a lot of people would say that at the end of the day, it wouldn't have worked if they hadn't been prepared to use violence. Have Yanukovych, who was the leader of Ukraine, was clued into how to stop a non-violent revolution. I mean, do you feel that dictators and authoritarian leaders are getting cleverer? They know your tactics? Mm-hmm. And now one has to take the extra step forward. Again, another example. In Russia, they had a perfect non-violent process. It was beautiful. But because they weren't able to take the step into a more kind of confrontational mode, it kind of fizzled. Mm-hmm. Do you feel dictators have got cleverer? And do you feel that actually maybe the non-violent strategy is reaching sort of an end of a cycle?
Well, it's I wouldn't really look at it as a cycle in terms of non-violent movements. I think non-violent movements are constantly learned. The fact that we are witnessing now, and there is also a great book about it, wrote by Will Dobson, a political editor in Slate, which is called Dictator's Learning Curve. And I think dictators are learning a lot, and they're learning very fast, and they're investing a lot of resources in understanding how to prevent groups to get united, how to prevent them even to get to the street, because they understand that once you have a lot of the people protesting, then you're in a defense. So they want to stay on the offense. I mean, the Russia created their own youth movement called Nashi to fill in the social and political space after Georgia and Ukraine happened in 2003 and 2004. The movement in the meantime failed because it didn't have anything to do, but it was there to prevent the real pro-democracy movement to come in. Wherever you look at the propaganda level, they're satanizing the very idea of the nonviolent struggle every day through pro-Russian media. So, you know, they're learning, they're on the offense. And I think the reason why we wrote this book is to put a little bit more light on the skills from the good side of the world and say, okay, this is the battlefield of the future, it's knowledge. In 21st century, I hardly doubt that the real difference would be who have more nuclear rockets, because, you know, outside of North Korea, nobody would probably try even to shoot it in a probe. But when you're looking at the struggle, when you're looking at the social engineering, when you're looking at the public mobilizing, I think the struggle of 21st century is where the good guys will learn how to empower people, or the bad guys will learn how to keep people out of power.
I think that's very, very true. There's a huge report for the Pentagon by Stephen Halper from Cambridge University about Chinese non-military tactics. And he ends that line that the battles of the 21st century will be about who tells the better story, not about who has the more guns.
I mean, look at the ISIS. I think the struggling non-state actors like ISIS is probably another very big challenge, together with how dictators learn. And I think when you look at them, it's like there is a place. We spoke with Syrians who were expelled from the territories now controlled by ISIS. And one of the things they say is like we need to be the narrative of these people. Because unlike other extremist groups, ISIS somehow, use of the media, tended to be cool. So this cool factor is basically the traditional territory of the nonviolent movements. But you can see the very violent and extreme group building their narrative on this territory. So challenging it on this territory, for me, it's far more important than killing the mosquitoes, which is what you do with bombs.
That's very interesting, because basically you set out a blueprint for revolution, and all the civic groups involved in your book are all, you know, they all reflect sort of values that we share, democracy, sort of human rights. But essentially the same tactics could be used by a negative force that, you know, had a very different set of values. At the end of the day, is it just a sequence of technologies? Could any side, good or bad, use the same things?
In part. When it comes to the ideology, I think that what is the limitation of nonviolent tactics to the positive side of the world is that you're basically winning by numbers. So, and numbers are always kind of the mainstream. It's very difficult to expect that you will turn, you know, France from, you know, 20% or 10% of right-wing nuts supporting Marine Le Pen to the 67% of the right-wing nuts, you know, supporting kicking out of the immigrants. So we can see outsider groups using some of these tactics, but there is a limited capacity of growth. If you're a dictator, or if you're sticking to the fringe of the society, then you will never be able or capable to mobilize enough numbers to perform the durable social change. However, knowledge of these tactics and use of these tactics in a situation like Donbas from Putin, where he was obviously using a mix. There is a great piece I read by Maciej Barkowski in SAIS, the use of this hybrid tactics, how nonviolent people were pushed into the nonviolent tactics of separatism. And then, you know, when they were challenged with a military and police force from the Ukrainian state, they were kind of equipped, you know, the little green men pop up, and then they are kind of protecting protesters. But it's a very, very interesting case in how not only how Russia learned to use these tactics, but this is probably how the social battlefield will look in the 21st century. So aside of my very non-scientific book, it's a role of organizations who do the research, the organizations like Legatum Institute, for example, to put more lights on this process.
This is all very exciting. So please, whoever's watching this, do read Sitter's wonderful book. It's a fantastic read, and also incredibly useful. And I think you're quite right. It's not just about what's going on now. It's a little window onto the conflicts of the 21st century. Actually, what started in Belgrade and spread through Georgia at a grassroots level will more and more become sort of part of national tactics and international relations. So there's a lot to find in your wonderful book. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.